Okay, so let's just ground ourselves for a second here. Today is Monday, June 22nd, 2026.
Right.
And I mean, just 5 days ago, we saw an absolute, I mean, really geopolitical earthquake happen.
Oh, totally, Versailles.
Exactly, at the Palace of Versailles. You've got
Yep.
the United States and Iran signing the Islamabad Memorandum, which is this, this 14-point ceasefire that finally paused a conflict that has just been, well, it's been raging across the Middle East.
Yeah, and to actually understand what that ink on the page means, you really have to look back at the last 18 months. I mean, we're talking 18 months of literal fire, naval blockades, just total economic collapse.
Right, which forced both of these nations into that room in the first place.
Exactly. It's an incredibly complex trajectory to map out. I mean, we are looking at a timeline that basically pushed the entire globe to the absolute brink.
It really did. So for this deep dive, to parse out how we arrived at this really fragile truce, we're relying on two main things. First, a really comprehensive historical log that goes day by day through the 2025 and 2026 negotiations and conflicts.
Which is wild to read in retrospect.
Yeah, and we're pairing that with a really fascinating financial strategy document from the Amundi Research Center, which was written right in the middle of the chaos back in 2025.
Yeah, those two sources are essential because together they kind of give us the whole board. You
Yeah.
know, like we aren't just looking at troop movements here.
Right, because this is about why it matters to you
Yeah.
listening to this. This isn't just distant maps and missiles.
No, not at all. We are looking at how this crisis threatened the literal security of the global economy. I mean, the price of the energy that powers your commute, and just how dangerously close the world came to a like a permanent disruption of international trade.
Which is terrifying. So our mission today is to cut through all the breaking news and explain how we got from a 60-day ultimatum in early 2025 to where we are now. And to see where it started, we really have to look back at the pressure cooker of spring 2025.
Yeah, late 2024 is when the IAEA, the UN's nuclear watchdog, they found that Iran had amassed near weapons-grade uranium. And so by March 2025, President Trump reinstated this maximum pressure campaign.
You sent a letter, right?
Yeah, a letter directly to Iran's supreme leader, Ali Khamenei, and it had a strict 60-day deadline for full nuclear dismantlement.
60 days. I mean, that 60-day clock fundamentally altered the pace of international diplomacy.
Oh, completely. Behind the scenes, these frantic secret talks just spun up in Oman and Rome. And it's crazy because the U.S. delegation, which was led by Special Envoy Steve Witkoff,
Yeah.
and the Iranian delegation, led by Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi, they weren't even sitting in the same room.
Wait, really? Not even in the same room?
No, they were literally passing messages through Omani mediators.
Wow. And during those back channel talks, the sources show Iran actually put forward a highly specific three-step proposal,
Yeah.
which surprised me.
Yeah, they did.
They offered to lower their uranium enrichment down to 3.67%, and they offered
Yeah.
to allow surprise IAEA inspections.
Right, but in exchange.
Right. In exchange, they wanted access to their frozen financial assets in the U.S. and, the authorization to freely export their oil again.
But the U.S. negotiators looked at that proposal and just, I mean, they hit it with a sledgehammer.
Yeah.
Under that maximum pressure directive, the United States demanded the complete, absolute dismantling of Iran's enrichment capabilities.
So not lowering it.
No, zero enrichment. They demanded the physical destruction of the underground facilities at Natanz and Fordo and Isfahan, too.
See, putting a strict, highly public 60-day deadline on something this complex, I mean, it feels like trying to negotiate a hostage release while both sides are holding a lit match.
That's a really good way to put it.
The blast is practically inevitable. But I have to push back on the structural logic of the U.S. demand here. Like, if Iran was actively offering to lower enrichment to civilian grade, that 3.67%, and agreed to surprise inspections, why did the U.S. refuse?
Oh,
Like, was
right.
demanding absolute zero enrichment just structurally impossible from the start?
To understand the U.S. refusal, you really have to look at the physics of uranium enrichment, and specifically this concept of breakout time.
Well, breakout time. What is that?
Breakout time is the physical time it takes a country to produce enough weapons-grade uranium for one nuclear bomb if they decide to, just sprint for it.
Right, if they just go all in.
Exactly. So, from the U.S. perspective, allowing any domestic enrichment infrastructure to remain intact, even if it's currently spinning at a harmless 3.67%.
It's still there.
Right. It means Iran retains the centrifuges, they have the technical know-how, the facilities. If they ever decided to just kick the UN inspectors out, they could simply turn the dials up and break out toward a bomb in a matter of weeks.
So the U.S. wanted the infrastructure just pulverized.
Completely. So that a breakout was governed by the laws of physics, making it physically impossible rather than just politically paused.
But the flip side of that is Iran's perspective, right? Where maintaining domestic enrichment is framed as this inalienable national right. Telling a regime to physically blow up its own billions of dollars of infrastructure, I mean, functionally, you're asking them to publicly humiliate themselves on the global stage.
Which they were never going to do. And that rigid structural incompatibility on both sides led directly to the snapping point.
June 12th.
June 12, 2025. The IAEA officially declared Iran in breach of its obligations. And literally the very next day, Israel launched massive preemptive strikes against Iran's military leadership and nuclear
And
scientists.
then the U.S. followed up.
A week later, June 21st, heavy strikes on the Fordo and Natanz nuclear sites, which sparked what became known as the 12-day war.
And that eruption of kinetic warfare, it didn't just rattle the diplomats. It sent this violent shockwave through global financial markets. Which actually brings us to our second source.
The Amundi Report.
Yeah, the investment briefing from the Amundi Research Center, which was published right as the bombs started falling in June 2025. We actually get to see how the money managers, you know, the quants in Paris and Wall Street, how they model war.
Yeah, and it's fascinating. When the 12-day war broke out, Brent crude oil spiked to $78 a barrel intraday.
Which was the biggest single jump the market had seen since March 2022.
Because when financial analysts look at a conflict in the Middle East, they aren't looking at politics. They're looking at the raw, unforgiving physics of supply.
The oil.
The oil. Iran produces roughly 4.7 million barrels of oil a day. But the actual nightmare scenario for the markets wasn't just taking Iranian oil offline, it was the Strait of
The
Hormuz.
Strait of Hormuz. I mean, this is essentially the jugular vein of the global energy supply.
It really is.
We're talking about a waterway that is only 21 miles wide at its narrowest point, yet 20 million barrels of oil transit through it every single day.
It's a profound geographical bottleneck. And the Amundi analysts modeled out several scenarios based on that geography.
What did they find?
They noted that a full Iranian blockade of the strait, whether through deploying sea mines, fast attack craft, or anti-ship missiles, could send global oil surging anywhere between $100 and $120 a barrel.
Oh, wow. $120.
Yeah, massive spike. But crucially, Amundi advised their investors that a complete blockade was highly unlikely.
Say, I need to challenge that financial logic.
Okay, go for it.
Amundi confidently told investors that Iran wouldn't block the strait because the regime desperately needed whatever oil revenue it could get to just survive.
Right, the rational actor theory.
But when a country is facing literal bunker buster bombs falling on its sovereign territory, does a financial spreadsheet still apply? I mean, it seems like market analysts have a massive blind spot for geopolitical desperation.
I get that, but put yourself in the shoes of an Amundi analyst for a second. You're looking at a macroeconomic model. From their perspective, Iran's economy was already on life support from years of sanctions. So blocking the strait means cutting off their own oil exports, which is economic suicide. They assume the regime would act as a rational economic agent and choose financial survival over retaliation, especially to avoid alienating regional allies like Qatar, who, you know, also rely on that waterway.
But where their model breaks down is underestimating the psychology of a regime that might be willing to burn the house down with them inside. Because when your survival is threatened by kinetic military action, the calculus shifts from how do we balance the budget to how do we inflict maximum pain on our adversaries to make them stop.
And the historical log proves that economic models really struggle to quantify asymmetrical warfare. Amundi was absolutely right about the sheer depth of the economic desperation, but they were vastly incorrect about the timeline.
How it would play out.
How that desperation would manifest. The aftermath of the 2025 12-day war plunged Iran into absolute financial ruin. By mid-2026, the data showed an astonishing 60% of Iranians reporting they could not survive financially.
60%. I mean, that level of poverty doesn't just stay on a balance sheet, it hits the streets. The economic devastation sparked massive nationwide protests across Iran. The regime was suddenly fighting a two-front war, one against Western military pressure and one against its own starving populace.
Which is what backed them into a corner, right? It forced the resumption of talks in early 2026.
Yeah, and the atmosphere in those early 2026 talks in Oman and Geneva, it was a masterclass in terrifying
The
brinkmanship.
cast of characters expanded significantly, too.
Oh, big time. The U.S. brought in Vice President J.D. Vance and Special Envoy Jared Kushner, alongside, military heavyweights like CNTCOM Commander Admiral Brad Cooper.
And Iran countered by bringing in the Speaker of their Parliament and Ali Larijani, the Secretary of their Supreme National Security Council.
So the stakes were exponentially higher. And we know this because Steve Witkoff came out of the Geneva talks and revealed something just chilling.
Yeah, this was the turning point.
The Iranian negotiators sat at the table and openly boasted that their stockpile of 460 kilograms of 60% enriched uranium was enough to produce 11 nuclear bombs.
You really need to pause here and explain why that specific number, 60% enrichment, why that is so deeply alarming to nuclear watchdogs.
Right, because 60 doesn't sound like 100.
Exactly. But uranium enrichment is not a linear process, it's exponential. Think of it like purifying heavily contaminated water. The hardest, most time-consuming part of the whole process is getting it from 0 to 3.67%.
Okay.
Going from 3.67 to 20% is faster. But once you have a stockpile sitting at 60%, the amount of time and effort required to spin those centrifuges up to 90%, which is weapons grade, is terrifyingly short.
Like how short?
It is a matter of days or weeks.
Wow. So bragging about having the material for 11 bombs sitting at the 60% threshold, I mean, that's a catastrophic misread of leverage.
It really is.
It's like showing your poker opponent you have a royal flush while simultaneously asking them for a loan. You don't tell the United States you are weeks away from 11 nuclear weapons when the U.S. military is already hovering off your coast, threatening action to stop you from getting even one.
And the reaction to that boast was swift and devastating. On February 28, 2026, the United States and Israel launched a massive coordinated strike campaign across Iran.
This wasn't just hitting infrastructure anymore.
No, this escalated far beyond the infrastructure targeting we saw in 2025. These strikes decapitated the Iranian leadership. They killed Supreme Leader Ali Khamenei, and they killed Ali Larijani, the very man who had been overseeing the diplomatic negotiations.
Taking out the Supreme Leader. I mean, that fundamentally fractured the Iranian power structure. And the U.S. didn't stop there. By April 2026, President Trump initiated a full U.S. naval blockade of Iranian ports.
And a blockade of that magnitude, the logistical footprint is staggering.
Yeah.
It means deploying carrier strike groups, guided missile destroyers, advanced radar nets to physically choke off the flow of goods. You have boarding parties intercepting cargo ships, literally cutting off the economic and caloric intake of an entire nation.
So looking at the timeline here, the U.S. demanding the absolute destruction of Fordo and OTANs, Iran boasting about 11 bombs, the massive military buildups happening in the background. It makes me question the entirety of the early 2026 Geneva talks.
House.
Were those meetings ever actually about finding peace, or were they just a geopolitical stalling tactic while both sides loaded their weapons?
Honestly, the historical log strongly points to the talks being a theater of diplomacy, masking a countdown to war.
Wow.
While the negotiators were sitting in rooms in Geneva, the U.S. was quietly executing the largest military buildup in the Middle East since the 2003 Iraq invasion.
And Iran.
Simultaneously, Iran was using the time to accelerate its enrichment. They were physically hardening their underground facilities with new concrete and deploying advanced Chinese anti-stealth radar systems. Neither side showed any willingness to concede their core red lines.
So the table is just a distraction.
The negotiating table simply served as a holding pattern while the military assets moved into their final positions.
Well, the kinetic reality of those moving pieces, the death of the Supreme Leader, the strangulation of the naval blockade, and just the sheer exhaustion of two nations running on fumes that finally forced the creation of the document signed just days ago.
Right.
The Islamabad Memorandum of Understanding, digitally signed and then physically celebrated at Versailles on June 17th, 2026.
This is the 14-point memo that has officially paused the conflict. The most immediate impacts are a 60-day ceasefire, the immediate end of the U.S. naval blockade, and critically for the global markets, the reopening of the Strait of Hormuz, toll-free for the duration of those 60 days.
And on the nuclear front, the text states Iran agrees to maintain the status quo of its program and not procure nuclear weapons. Economically, the memo outlines the potential release of frozen Iranian assets and begins discussions around a massive $300 billion reconstruction fund to rebuild the country.
And looking at the historical log, the reactions to the contents of this memorandum are intensely polarized across the geopolitical spectrum.
Yeah, and we must explicitly state here we are not taking political sides at all.
No, definitely not.
We are merely reporting the contrasting views from the sources. But, you know, President Trump is publicly framing this memorandum as an unconditional surrender by Iran, vindicating his maximum pressure campaign.
Right. Meanwhile, former President Barack Obama has released statements highly critical of the memo, arguing it is unlikely to improve upon the strict metrics of his 2015 JCPOA nuclear deal.
And inside Iran?
Inside Iran, the power vacuum left by the supreme leader's death has created total chaos. Regime hardliners are deeply divided over whether these concessions were necessary for survival. While the Iranian opposition in the diaspora is furiously condemning the ceasefire, basically demanding the world push for full regime change instead of tossing the current government a lifeline.
It's just a mess.
Yeah.
And I think the comparison to the 2015 JCPOA is the crucial analytical lens here. The 2015 deal was built on highly specific, verifiable technical metrics. It required Iran to cut its enrichment capacity by two-thirds.
Right.
It forced them to physically ship 96% of their enriched uranium stockpile out of the country, and it strictly capped all remaining enrichment at that 3.67% civilian grade.
Exactly. Contrast that with this new 2026 MOU. It simply asks Iran to maintain the status quo and promises they won't procure a weapon. There is no concrete enforcement mechanism detailed in the 14 points.
None at all.
No. Everything difficult is deferred to be solved within the 60-day ceasefire window.
Honestly, this sounds less like a peace treaty and more like hitting the pause button on a demolition timer, like putting a Band-Aid on a bullet wound and giving it exactly 60 days to heal. The clock has stopped ticking for 60 days, but all the wiring, the centrifuges, the 60% enriched uranium, it's all still totally intact.
Yeah, diplomatic analysts refer to this tactic as constructive ambiguity.
Constructive ambiguity.
Yeah. By keeping the language vague and deferring the hardest issues like verification protocols and the fate of the highly enriched stockpiles, both Washington and Tehran can present the arrangement as a massive victory to their domestic audiences.
I see.
The U.S. can claim they halted the nuclear threat and forced a surrender through the blockade, while the remnants of the Iranian regime can claim they survived an unprecedented military onslaught, kept their nuclear infrastructure, and successfully got the blockade lifted.
So it's a win-win for PR.
Right. But it is fundamentally a de-escalation mechanism. It's a pause button to stop the bleeding rather than a comprehensive settlement.
Okay, so let's pull all of this together for you, the listener. Over the last 18 months, you have witnessed a geopolitical masterclass in escalation.
Truly.
We tracked the journey from a rigid maximum pressure ultimatum in early 2025 straight into the kinetic strikes of the 12-day war. We saw the profound vulnerability of the global economy when the Strait of Hormuz is threatened.
And how economic collapse forced desperate actors back to a negotiating table where, you know, a catastrophic miscalculation led to the death of a supreme leader and a strangling naval blockade.
Exactly. Yeah. It highlights exactly why relying on a single breaking news alert is just insufficient. Understanding this ceasefire requires analyzing the diplomatic history, the financial models like the Amundi report, and the cold military reality.
Yeah, only then can you see the intricate web of cause and effect that brought us to Versailles.
Right, and now we are sitting in a highly fragile 60-day window where the fate of the Middle East hangs in the balance.
Mm.
But, and this is wild, there's one detail buried in the source material that I want to leave you with. Because it could change the physical mechanics of the world forever.
The tolls?
Yes, the tolls. Oh. The new MOU guarantees that the Strait of Hormuz will remain open and toll-free for the 60-day ceasefire. But President Trump floated a very specific structural threat.
Yeah.
He stated that if a final peace deal isn't reached when those 60 days expire, the U.S. might implement a toll. They would begin charging countries for U.S. Guardian Angel Protection Services to safely transit their oil tankers through the strait.
Which is, I mean, implementing a toll system enforced by a superpower fundamentally rewrites the rules of the globalations.
It really does. Think about the precedent that sets. If those 60 days expire without a permanent deal, we could see the complete privatization and militarization of global maritime trade routes.
Yeah, it's wild to think about.
Imagine a world where the free navigation of the seas, a concept that has been a cornerstone of the global economy for centuries, is replaced by a global protection racket. Would every cargo ship carrying the energy and goods you buy every day eventually need to pay a superpower just to cross the ocean?
It's a terrifying thought experiment.
It really is. So the next time you see a headline about these diplomatic negotiations, remember the underlying mechanics of what is actually at stake, because the 60-day countdown has started all over again.